Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Well, it's time to do a Meet the Candidates moment here on the Behind the Curtain podcast. We're all going to be voting for a new governor next year, and or keeping the old one. But on the Democratic side, lots of folks want that nomination and want to be able to take on Bruce Rauner in the general election. So over time, I'll be introducing you to these candidates. And this week, we meet State Senator Daniel Biss. He's out of Evanston. He is a mathematician, math whiz. Man, I just know now how he ought to be able to fix the budget himself since he can do all that. We'll find out if he can as we say hi to him. Senator Biss, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Paul.
So how much does that mathematical skill and ability you have really come into play when it comes to budgets and numbers? Or is it a different kind of a thing?
Well, listen, it sure doesn't hurt, Paul. And I don't want to pretend that I was an economist or a budgeteer. I was a pure abstract mathematician. But I learned a few things. One is I learned how to take a skeptical attitude about data that people showed me. And I learned how to ask tough questions. I also learned how to, you know, process information pretty quickly and not just get kind of tricked as people with an agenda might come by with a particular request. And I learned how to listen well because I spent a lot of time in the classroom. And I think we've got a government in Illinois that doesn't do a lot of listening, doesn't do a lot of asking tough questions, and does a lot of perpetuating the status quo. And that's really not helpful to our state, or especially not to the people who government most exists to serve.
You've been presenting yourself as sort of a progressive candidate, but I have to be honest with you, so many of your opponents on the Democratic side are also presenting themselves as progressive candidates. I guess everybody takes a shift away from Bruce Rauner. So given the fact that you've got others on your side who also call themselves progressive, why are you the more progressive, the real progressive, or are you all just truly progressive and we respect that between all of you then, amongst yourselves?
Well, I think we need to take a look at a couple things. One is positions on issues, and one is record. So I am the only major candidate in this race who is supporting a healthcare for all, a Medicare for all system here in the state of Illinois. And that's something that is really, I think, important to progressives, important to everybody else. To have a system where you no longer are concerned about keeping a particular employer because of your need to have health insurance, where people who want to start a business can just do it knowing that they'll have access to affordable care. This is a fundamental issue that I think the Democratic Party is really asking tough questions about right now, and it's disappointing to me that some of the other front runners in this race have not come out in support of a Medicare for All plan. I'm the only candidate among the major candidates in this race who has come out in support of a LaSalle Street tax to make sure that the financial sector pays its share as we're trying to figure out how to enact a budget. That's an important progressive issue that I think is of importance in figuring out which candidate is likely to advance a real progressive cause. But I also think it's important, Paul, to ask about where candidates have been. You know, so one issue that fortunately all the candidates, or most of the candidates at least, seem to agree on is a progressive taxation. Illinois is one of only four states in the union whose constitution says that we have to have a flat income tax, whose constitution says that if we wanted to ask Bruce Rauner, who in 2015 made $188 million, if we wanted to ask him to pay a higher rate than someone making $35,000, that would actually be illegal under the Illinois constitution. So fortunately, the candidates in this race have mostly come out in favor of changing that and fixing our constitution so that we would have a system like most states that would allow us to ask Bruce Rauner to pay a higher tax rate than someone making much less money.
So
the question, though, is who's actually going to get that done? The question is who's been fighting for that throughout a career? When I first started running for office in an affluent district that wasn't necessarily so crazy about these kinds of ideas, I was fighting for this. And in my time in the legislature, I've been fighting for this because we are not going to solve the state's problems if we don't have the guts to finally ask the richest residents to pay their share. I'm sad to say that most other candidates in this race, even those who have now taken a poll and figured out that that's the right political position to take, have not spent a career fighting for it, have not taken a position until very recently. And so if voters are looking for not just who is saying progressive things right now, but who is going to be a reliable progressive who will be the one to enact these bold policies, I think I'm the clear choice.
So the progressive tax, which a lot of the candidates are supporting, either have been or are now, I understand the argument that it kind of fixes the situation because richer people pay more. It would also mean poorer people maybe don't pay at all, depending on how the categories get created. But we've got, what, nearly a $200 billion deficit in the pension fund. We've got unpilled bills of billions of dollars there. I mean, even if you were to change the tax system, it wouldn't happen until 1921, 1922. It's a constitutional change. What are you going to do to address the current pension problem, the current backlog of bills, other than do what the legislature did this last season, which was, well, we'll just raise taxes to 5%?
You know, it's a great question because you're right. The kind of solutions I'm pushing for are structural, long-term solutions that fix the underlying brokenness of our state. And some of them will take some time to enact. And in the meantime, we've got an emergency right now. And there are some who say, because we have an emergency right now, don't worry about the long-term. I would say the opposite. We have an emergency right now because we've gone way too long without worrying about the long-term here in Illinois. And so your question is very fair. As we're fighting for the right long-term structural solutions that right the wrongs that Illinois has engaged in for far too long, what do we do first? Well, several things. We need to make sure that our government acts as efficiently as possible. We need to break down the barriers inside our state and local governments that have resulted in a system that's got a lot of fiefdoms, a lot of places where an individual political group might have a lot of influence, but where the service being provided to the public is not so great. We need to think about consolidating the 628 different pension funds that exist in Illinois. That's not a mechanism that enables us to provide retirement security for public workers. It's a mechanism that allows vendors to pull money out of a bunch of different pension systems. And so we need to find these mechanisms to make government work not just less expensively, but better, because that's the only way to address these budget problems in a way that's not going to be harmful to the people who government exists to support.
One of the reasons Bruce Rauner, if he were to admit this, would say he couldn't get his agenda accomplished, whether you agree with it or not, was he was up against a formidable foe in Mike Madigan, Speaker of the House. Well, Mike Madigan ain't going anywhere anytime soon. And so my question to you is, if you disagree with Mike Madigan, he seems to hold the plate. He seems to be able to keep any governor in check. And yet there's a lot of dissension about Mike Madigan. Where do you stand in your relationship with him? And what makes you think that you would be in a control position if you and the speaker disagreed about something?
Listen, Mike Madigan has been there too long and he's too powerful. And I've been clear about that for a long time. That's why when I first joined the legislature back in 2011, I fought for term limits for legislative leaders because I don't think it makes sense for someone who is elected by just under 1% of the state to accrue more and more power over the entire state during the course of a career. And that's really, you know, where I've been. It's where I am today. But the other place that I've been, even as someone who's in the opposite branch of the Democratic Party than Mike Madigan, is I have been willing to work with anyone, to move an agenda forward that lifts up the people in Illinois. And I know the legislature, and I understand the legislature. And I've been able to pass more than 80 bills into law in the legislature, and that has been a set of experiences that no other candidate in this race has. It's a set of experiences that means that when I become governor, I'm going to know who agrees and who disagrees and who's persuadable. I'm going to know how to build those coalitions, and I'm going to know how to use the outside influence of a movement of people across the state to push Mike Madigan and the Illinois legislature to do the right thing for Illinois. We need a governor with bold, progressive ideas, and we also need a governor who understands exactly how to work the legislature with a record of accomplishment, and that's the governor that I'm going to be.
you have in the speaker, you have budgets that get proposed. I know the budget's supposed to come from the governor, but that doesn't really happen very much. And so you'll have, you know, again, it's this constant push for new revenue, new sources, maybe new taxes. You know, there probably new service taxes will be down the line. Once again, how would you look at people? You talk about a progressive tax. Should voters have any concern that that also means that a Governor Biss would also be finding other new ways of taxing different things, creative as they might be, like a soda beverage tax, to gain new revenue? Is that the approach?
Well, I think we've got to be honest with ourselves that Illinois has been a state that has gotten revenue by nickeling and diming the middle class and poor people. And that's wrong. That's not the right way to raise revenue. And that's why in Illinois we have one of the most regressive tax codes of any state in the union. There's only about three, maybe four states that have a more unfair tax code than we have. In Illinois, if you're in the bottom fifth, you pay about 13%. If you're in the top 1%, you pay 4%. Let me say that again. If you're at the top, you pay 4. If you're at the bottom, you pay 13. And so that is not a fair tax code. It's not a tax code like other states. And that's because our Constitution has not allowed us to get revenue where it's actually available by taxing the richest residents who have for generations not paid their share because they've bought the election system. And instead, it's one tax after another that impacts the very people without the ability to pay.
Does your plan indicate what those levels would be? Do we know how high the rich would pay under your plan?
Well, we need to be willing to sit down and negotiate that with all parties, and I'm not going to be inflexible. I'm not going to be someone who's going to declare exactly how things have to be. But I would point out that we've got neighboring states. You know, you don't have to look at California or New York, New Jersey. We've got neighboring states that bring in significant additional revenue through their income tax by having rates of, you know, in the 7 and 8% range for the very, very top earners. And so you don't need to be a state that goes into those double-digit tax rates that places like New York and California do. And you don't need to punish the poor. You don't need to punish the middle class. You just need to be willing to ask the richest residents to pay a reasonable rate. And that does a tremendous amount to tackle the budget problems.
Then there's, of course, the working people. Here we are talking about taxes and the rich and all that kind of thing. And yet you have people going, I'm making minimum wage, man. I'm making $8.75 an hour. I know you support the $15 an hour, but you have to bring business to Illinois. That's what Governor Rauner's been trying to do. We could just debate his success at it. But some say that raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour would mean businesses do not want to come here. I've actually talked to some business owners recently, and I asked them about that. I'm like, don't you really want to raise the minimum wage? And they really are. And these are decent people. And they're like, no, I really can't do business. It would put me out of business to do it. And I'm sincere about that, they say. How do you resolve it?
Well, first of all, I don't think there's any debate about Governor Rauner's record on job creation. It's been an absolute disaster. It's an embarrassment. The state of Illinois' economy is in worse shape than it was when he took office, which is just inexcusable. Now, I take those concerns about the job impact of the minimum wage seriously, but I think you also need to contextualize them. Number one, we've got real economic problems in Illinois because our poverty rate is high, and so people don't have money to spend. And so it might be true that raising the minimum wage today would be a hardship for some businesses, but it also would restart our economy in a fundamental way by putting money in the pockets of people who would then be able to spend it. And so you need to ask yourself not just what would be the, you know, 3-week time horizon of a minimum wage increase, what would be the 1-year and 2-year and 5-year and 10-year horizon? And I can tell you that when people in the community have money to spend, business does better. And so if you look at states that have raised the minimum wage, you see, for example, a place like Seattle with a high minimum wage, and a lot of people said the sky was falling, and yet if you actually look carefully at the numbers, what you see is that Seattle's economy is in great shape subsequent to the minimum wage increase. So these proposals that we have, for example, Senate Bill 81, that I was a proud co-sponsor of, to increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and that Bruce Rauner vetoed, taking the money out of the pockets of working people in Illinois, that is a proposal that would actually help the Illinois economy over time. And it's a real shame that Bruce Rauner didn't do the right thing and sign it. When I'm governor, I will.
I want to ask you, one of the reasons we didn't have a budget for a couple of years is because the governor had some requirements. He seemed to kind of cave on all of them. He might not admit that or agree with that, but let's just put it out there. So I actually have an ultimate question to ask you, but I've got a couple along the way. For Bruce Rauner, he said, I want a budget that has redistricting reform. Do you agree that we need redistricting reform?
I completely agree that we need redistricting reform. We've got a system where the voters don't choose the politicians. The politicians choose their voters. And I've been one of the Democrats who stood up for redistricting reform in the legislature, which is sometimes a lonely position. But I also think it's embarrassing that Bruce Rauner pretends that redistricting reform has anything to do with getting a budget. It's a ridiculous misdirection play. And we should be willing to talk about redistricting reform, how to have the right way to draw maps that's fair, that's open, that allows for all kinds of political views to be well represented in the legislature. But we also should have a budget. And Bruce Rauner's willingness to hold the budget hostage because of his personal interest in redistricting reform is just a sign that he's not fit to be governor. He doesn't understand how government works. He doesn't understand you have to compromise. He doesn't understand that if you don't get your way, the government still needs to exist, and you still need to be willing, able to fund schools and universities and social service providers. And that kind of hostage-taking attitude is just bad for all of us, and it's part of why Bruce Rauner has to go.
Governor said we want a budget, and if we can't have, and part of the deal there was, I want term limits, he says, and then it became term limits for leaders. What's your position on term limits?
I think term limits for leaders are a great idea. Like I think I mentioned earlier, I've been fighting for that since I first joined the legislature in 2011, because if you've got someone in a leadership position, like Speaker of the House, and they gain more and more power every year that they're there, but they're only really accountable to the voters of their own district, that's less than 1% of the state, that's not a good way to run a system. And so I support term limits for leadership, something I've been fighting for a long time, since long before it was in the headlines, something I'll keep on fighting for. I'm term limiting myself. I've served 8 years, and I'll be wrapping up at the end of 2018 when I become governor. And I think that's an appropriate amount of time for me to serve. I'm happy to have had the honor of serving in that capacity so far, and happy to move on to this next challenge.
Governor said, got to have a budget, but I need to have permanent property tax caps put into place. Then that became, well, give me 4 years. What's your view on property taxes in general? Should they go up, down, remain the same, freeze, what?
This is a great example of what Bruce Rauner gets wrong. Our property taxes in Illinois are way too high. That's just the fact. They're higher than any other state besides New Jersey. And so I think that we ought to have lower property taxes. And Bruce Rauner claims to think that we ought to have lower property taxes. The problem is that Bruce Rauner's approach isn't to actually tackle what got us here. His approach is to artificially cap property taxes in a way that would just hurt our schools. So how did we get here? We got here in two ways. Number one, we are more reliant on property taxes for school funding than any other state in the union. Any state in the union. And so that means that our property taxes are too high. It means our schools' funding is inequitable. It's a rotten way to run a system. And so the right thing to do is to reform our school funding system so that we are less property tax reliant, so that we have a fair tax system that finally asks the richest residents to pay their share, uses that money to properly fund schools, and then is able to bring down property taxes significantly. But because Bruce Rauner didn't want to fight for a fair tax system, he tried to just cap property taxes without doing anything else, and all that would do is hurt schools. So let's do it right. Let's have an honest conversation about how to enact the right policy. Let's not just pretend that a press release about property taxes being too high is going to solve anything for anybody.
So as I mentioned, this was kind of it turned out to be a four-part question, four in one. We just handled three of your views along the way, but here's the ultimate question. Those are the things Bruce Rauner fought for and essentially gave in on. My question is, what factor, what component, what policy, what program would a Governor Biss fight for, as Rauner fought for his, but gave in? What would you fight for, hold up a budget because of it, and ultimately, would you let things go to heck in terms of budget if you didn't get what you wanted?
Well, on that last question, you got to be a governor. You got to actually govern the state and run the state and allow it to move forward, and that means taking a tough negotiating line, but it also means compromising. It also means compromising. Now, I will tell you that my number one priority, the thing that we have to do if we're actually going to fix the problems, is to repeal the unfair, unjust flat tax provision in our Constitution that results in us overtaxing the middle class with high property taxes, overtaxing the working poor with fees that nickel and dime them, because we don't have the guts to ask the richest residents to finally pay their share.
But you can't hold up the budget for that, because that's a constitutional amendment. That's nothing the legislature can give you.
Well, the legislature certainly can give it by putting it on the ballot for a referendum.
That's true.
And that's exactly what we have to do. We have to change that by putting that on the ballot and going to the people and saying, hey, guess what? Illinois, if you think our tax system is unfair, you're right. It is. And here's how we're going to fix it together. And that's got to be priority number one. And then what do we do with that? We have a fair income tax system. We bring in adequate revenue to fund our schools properly. And we bring down property taxes. Those are the top priorities to have a system that's fair and just and economically reasonable and begins to move us in a sane direction so that after that we can start to do some of the really bold things that would transform our state.
My final question, Senator, which is, and you don't get to talk about Bruce Rauner in this answer because people have to have a vote prior to that in March. And they need to know why to vote for you over the other Democratic nominees. We all know none of you like Bruce Rauner. So as my final question, tell my listeners why Daniel Biss is the right candidate amongst the Democrats who want the role of governor.
We need a few things right now. We need someone who understands state government. I've been in the legislature. It'll be 8 years when I become governor, having passed over 80 bills into law, having built surprising coalitions to enact progressive priorities to lift people up across the state. Nobody else in this race has that experience. No one else in this race is going to become governor ready on day one, not just to kind of muddle through, but to change Illinois in a fundamental way. That's number one. Number two, we need a bold, progressive vision. Someone who's willing to fight for universal health care. Someone who's willing to fight for a fair tax system that asks people on Wall Street and LaSalle Street to pay their share instead of middle-class workers and the poor in Illinois. We need to have a bold vision that shows the people of Illinois that we don't need to be doomed to this kind of sluggish government that has held us back for so long. I'm a candidate with a bold, progressive agenda that the people of Illinois, I think, will find very exciting. And finally, there's a lot of pressure, I know, to pick some of the other candidates. There's, Mike Madigan's eager to make sure that Pritzker gets elected because of this sense that Pritzker is able to self-finance, and that'll be helpful in running against Bruce Rauner. I think we ought to ask ourselves, are we having an election or are we having an auction? This is a moment that the Democratic Party gets to decide who it's going to be and how we're going to include more people and inspire more people and excite more people. I think if we want to do that, we shouldn't go to the candidate with the most money. We should go to the candidate with the best ideas and the strongest volunteer organization. I'm that candidate. I would be honored to have the support and participation of everybody listening right now.
Senator Daniel Biss, State Senator Daniel Biss, wants to be governor. Got to get that Democratic nomination first. We wish you well. We're going to keep our eye on the race as it goes along, and I sure hope you'll come back and visit at the appropriate times when it comes down the line.
Thanks so much. I look forward to it.
Thanks, Senator. Have a good time on the road.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
I knock on the cockpit door like we're trained to do. It opens, and my whole world changes. I see no panic, but it is immediately evident that we have a critical situation. This isn't an emergency. This is a goddamn crisis, and I don't usually talk that way. The pilots are wrenching their control wheels back and to the left, but the plane just keeps tipping more and more steeply to the right. Captain Al Haynes tells me the hydraulic system isn't working. I don't know what that means, but I know that it feels like the plane wants to roll over onto its back, and I think this situation means we can go straight down. He says to me, secure the cabin and prep the passengers for evacuation.
So, as we get you ready, are you feeling
God,
the tension?
Don't leave me someplace else.
Are you feeling the stress? It's what people felt who were on United Flight 232. Many years ago, back in, I think, 1989, it was a DC-10 coming to O'Hare. It's a true story. 296 people were aboard, and 44 minutes of torture leading to what some of us remember, that emergency landing and crash at Sioux City, Iowa's Gateway Airport. Several people survived, 184 of them survived, but what a story. It's a story that got written about in a book and translated to the stage, which you can now see in a play called United Flight 232. It's at the House Theater of Chicago, or I should say presented by the House Theater of Chicago at the Upstairs Theater at the Chopin Theater on Division Street, 1543. I'm so happy that joining me now is the actress who you just heard doing that monologue, Brenda Berry. She is a House Theater Company member. She plays Jan Brown. Jan was the chief flight attendant, and that was her performing in that role. Brenda, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
And directing the show, adapting the show from the original book about United Flight 232, Vanessa Stalling, back working at the House, where she's a company member now. She's done other sorts of wonderful directing. She's worked at Goodman Theater, so many of the great theaters around, but now she's had this project to work on. Vanessa, thanks for joining me as well.
Thank you, too.
And then one of my favorite people on the planet, Eric Schroeder, who used to be with Looking Glass Theater, and then he left town, I thought, never to be seen again. He went to New York. He was going to become like this huge, well-known star. Well, he did become this huge, well-known person, but he's back. And I was so thrilled to find out that he's back in the form of working with the House Theater of Chicago. He's the managing director. And so I said, please get Eric to join us. He made time. He's with me. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to Chicago.
I'm thrilled to be here, Paul. Thank you so much.
Well, you're such a talent, and it's such a great place that you found this new home as you come back to Chicago. Let me start by putting this. We already have people tense from just that. Those words and that music. So, Vanessa, I'm going to come to you at first. I said a little bit about what the story was. I think I'm triggering some memory for people, but set this up for us. Tell us about this story, kind of where the play itself, where it picks up, what it's reflecting.
Sure. And, you know, the play, the circumstances of the play are the July 1989 plane crash of United Flight 232. But that's not really what I like to say the play is about. For me, the play is about our inherent sense of responsibility that we have for one another. When I read the interviews that Lawrence did in his book, which, you know, he did this phenomenal comprehensive research of the book.
Right, and that book, we should give him credit because he's an Evanston native or Evanston resident. His name is Lawrence Gonzalez, who wrote this book.
Right, Flight 232. And when I read those interviews, that is the main thing that stood out for me, was it just reinforced my belief that we have an inherent sense of responsibility for one another and that the person across from you, the stranger across from you, more likely wants to do you good and have good things happen to you than bad. And that is quite evident in the actions of the events of this crash.
Brenda, you kind of scare the heck out of me as I listen to you and you tell that story. That's the sign of the good actress, I guess, or maybe a weak audience member. I don't know. But talk to me. I mean, listen, there are people. I'm not afraid of flying. I fly all the time and whatever. But I mean, tell us what we see, Brenda, on stage. I mean, what kind of sense do we get that we're on this airplane and the tension builds for us, even though it's a story about, you know, other things. But nevertheless, we do get the sense of what it was like to be on that plane.
Right. Vanessa does an amazing job of taking Lawrence's research and direct quotes from his interviews with survivors of Flight 232 and the flight crew especially. We get to see the flight crew not only step up their game as this is my job, as Jan Brown, chief flight attendant, I'm going to keep calm on this airplane, though this may be a crash landing at best. And I'm going to make sure that people feel taken care of, and there will not be panic on this plane. And you go up to the cockpit, you see Jan Brown experience what it is to look outside that plane that wants to roll over onto its back. But then you see her come out of the cockpit, keep calm, keep decorum, and walk down, continue doing her job, making sure the passengers feel prepared and understand what the brace position is, and checking in with other flight attendants to know that they need to be prepared for anything that should happen. But what you see, as Vanessa was touching on, is we really get to go to the heart of each person that's on this plane as well. So in addition to helping one another out, the compassion for one another, and also they had 44 minutes up in the air from the time they knew that this engine blew and there was a horrible sound. Immediately everyone worked to think about maybe what they would do differently in their life if they get a second chance, turn to the person next to them, get a plan of, okay, should something happen, I'm going to help get you out. Here's our nearest exit. Here's an alternative exit. People got to know one another. People laughed with one another. People prayed with one another. And Vanessa just does a good job of taking you through those intimate moments. And it's very human.
Yeah, and you know, it's everybody's one of our worst nightmares, right, of being in that kind of situation. And it makes you think of, for me, made me think of 9/11. It's just all these scenarios where you're trapped and what can you do? Eric, as managing director of the theater company, we heard Vanessa talk about the importance of sharing responsibility and those kinds of things. But I'm just curious, the mission of the House Theater, is it about bringing, well, as plays go on, is it about bringing real life, but asking larger questions about life for us? Is that what intrigued you to become managing director? Is that what the House Theater is all about? If not, correct me.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been a fan of the House for 15 years, and so what attracted me to the House was the mission is essentially performing amazing feats of storytelling and uniting Chicago in the spirit of community through those amazing feats of storytelling. So United Flight 232 absolutely fits in with that, within that that mission. This is it's an ensemble piece. It is very human. It is exciting. It is a non-traditional way to tell a story like this. You know, documentary theater has a lot of different forms, and I think that this is a quintessentially Chicago and this quintessentially House way to tell this story. But, I mean, the great thing about the House is that sense of adventure and the sense of heroism that you see on stage so often in our work here. And there's no question that there is extraordinary heroism happening on stage. You experience that, and it's so intimate, right? The theater has just about 100 seats, and so you're never more than four rows away from this incredible experience, this incredibly well-staged, beautiful piece of theater. And, you know, we're very fortunate. The show won Best Production at the Joseph Jefferson Awards last year. It also won Best Ensemble, and I think in Chicago, especially where ensemble theater was sort of developed. That's a huge, huge endorsement of the community, both the audience community and the artistic community. This piece is just an extraordinary experience.
Vanessa, were you influenced at all, or maybe this came first in terms of the remounting here, but when I think about the show, I think of Come From Away on Broadway in New York. It's a musical, and of course it's a 9/11 story, but it is the story of an ensemble group of people on a plane, and then, you know, having been forced to land, we kind of get their life on land. But I'm just curious, was any of that an influence for you, or were you thinking about that as you began to put this together?
No, you know, for me, it was I have a severe phobia of flying.
Ah.
And I was driving down Lakeshore Drive, and I was hearing Lawrence being interviewed on WBEZ about his book. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I need to read that book. And I was also going through, my father was very sick and passed away from the sickness, and so I was really going through a moment of grief and trying to figure out how to walk through life, what's my perspective walking through life, and it was as if this book just came to me at the exact right time, because as it is a story about our inherent sense of responsibility for one another, it's also about how do we handle terrible things that happen. You know, your instinct is you want to say that that's not fair. How do we comprehend it? How do we understand it? And through reading these interviews and then the creation of the play, I started to come to an understanding about how we can handle these moments of tragedy that are much larger than any of us on our own. But if we are together and we share that burden, and that's something that unites us, our ability to have pain and our ability to suffer, it's a way of being able to manage that type of grief.
And so that takes us to the depth of it, but it's also a human emotion. And Brenda, I want to ask you, unlike creating a character on stage, which is fictional, and you bring yourself to it, these are real people. They exist. I don't know, maybe some of them are gone now, but certainly they exist or existed. And I'm just curious, does that influence just playing real people? And this isn't like I'm going to present Queen Elizabeth, right? So these are real people, but they're regular people. How does that influence you as an actor?
It's been a tremendous gift, and it's felt like a great responsibility. I feel like to have been able to meet Jan Brown on so many different occasions and to develop a friendship with her, to be able to meet other people that we portrayed, portray on the stage with this experience is people are coming forward and saying, thank you, this has been cathartic, this has been healing. A mother of a child who was on the plane who survived, who's 9 years old and unaccompanied minor, said, thank you, this validates everything that I feel like I've held all these years. And it just feels like an honor. And so I guess
in terms of how this might feel different from playing a fictional character is that it just feels like a great responsibility in the best way. I want to be able to tell their story and be a vehicle for them and how others, as Vanessa's name, can relate to maybe their own walking through this life and dealing with difficult situations or trauma, and being able to reach out to the person next to you and say, I see you, I'm here for you, and sometimes that's just enough.
I'm curious, of course, United Flight 232, it's opening, I mean, it's playing now, but it's going to play till October 21st. Have any of these, Brenda, have any of the actual passengers shown, have they shown up to see the show? Or when you talk to Jan, do they say, I can't see this show?
It's it's been both. We've had people who came back, who came last year. We've had family members who said, you know, I wasn't able to come last year, but I feel ready to come this year, and they've come with us. Every night before the show, we have an awareness that someone could be in the audience that was impacted, that made the drive from Sioux City or the flight from Sioux City, for instance, or, you know, many of these passengers lived here in Chicago or in the surrounding areas. We know that they could be there, and we it has been an honor to come out after the show and meet different people. We had a woman this past week that came with Jan Brown, and she was in seat 4D in first row on United Flight 232, and it was incredible to meet her, and she remembered exactly which seat she sat in. She remembered so many various details of this event, and it was emotional, she said, to watch the show, but also healing, and she stayed after, and we got to talk after the show, and been a gift.
Eric, I'm going to let you kind of plug upcoming shows of the season, but do it in this way. Talk to me about how the impact of this show, and I don't know, maybe you've been there when some of these folks have been there or not, but talk to me as you look at the season ahead and what's coming, how this show kind of stands out for the powerful event and moment that it is.
Well, it's, you know, we have a pretty diverse array of programming this season, and I think that the main reason that this show sticks out is because it was so well received last year that it sold out very quickly, and not very many people, a lot of people who wanted to see it didn't get a chance. And that's the wonderful thing about having artists like Vanessa to collaborate with and to have the flexibility to say, we want more people to experience this show and to have the opportunity to bring it back, especially after it won the Jeff Award for Best Ensemble and Best Production. We thought we have to give more people the chance to see this show. And so it is truly a gift, as Brenda was just saying, to be able to share it again for a limited 8-week run through October 21st. But after this show, we have our annual production of The Nutcracker, which does not include any ballet. If you imagine such a thing.
Why? Who would think of ballet in The Nutcracker?
Right, exactly. So it takes the story from the Tchaikovsky ballet, and it updates it and makes it contemporary. It adds a little bit of a dark layer to it. And then it also adds a lot of sugar cookies and fake snow and live music and comedy and puppetry. It is an absolute blast, and it is so fun. It's actually become a big holiday tradition for a lot of families in Chicago, which we absolutely love. And then in the new year, we're bringing back a piece about the Hatfields and the McCoys with all new music. But that was a show that we did maybe 8-9 years ago that was very well received, and that we're thrilled to revisit that piece and bring all new music to it. It's got a cast of 21 people, again, live music. It takes place right after the Civil War, and the Hatfields and the McCoys, you know, everyone sort of feels like they know that story, but this is a really fun take on it, and it treats the folks of Appalachia with a lot of respect, and it's a lot of fun. And then after that, speaking of the Civil War, we have a play called Ellen Bond, Union Spy, which is about a freed woman named Mary Bowser who volunteers to join the Union Army as a spy. She has a photographic memory, and she ends up, this is a true story, her name is Mary Bowser, you can look it up on Wikipedia, and she goes and ends up in servitude at the Confederate White House, and then uses her photographic memory to sneak plans and maps and all sorts of other information out to the Union Army, and played a very instrumental role in the Union prevailing in that conflict.
I wonder if she was related to Bowser of Sha-Na-Na.
Definitely. and it's that piece is going to be a lot of fun because we're partnering with an organization called the Blue Rhythm Collective, and so they're going to infuse a lot of hip-hop and movement and dance into that piece. It's going to be an absolute
wow.
blast.
Brenda Berry, that role has your name all over it. Just thought I'd do a little casting from WGN Studios.
There you go.
Well, guys,
we have the Magic Parlor running every weekend, featuring founding company member and third generation magician Dennis Watkins at the Palmer House. So literally every Friday and Saturday, you can see incredible up close magic.
Yeah, I'm going to that actually in a couple of weeks. I want to check that out. Yeah, I'm going to be there.
Good. I'm so glad.
I'll tell you about that off air.
You will absolutely love it.
Will you tell me how he does all his tricks so I can surprise him?
If I knew, I probably wouldn't tell you.
He was on Penn and Teller Fool Us as well.
He was just like a week ago.
I love that show. But back to what we're really talking about here today. I did want to talk about the season because you guys do such important things. I want to encourage everybody to see United Flight 232 because you only have until October 21st, which before you know it is here. It's just a really intimate theater. As you said, Eric, you're only within a few rows away. The House Theater's on the, I think it's the second floor there, right, at the Chopin Theater.
Street level? Just a few steps up.
1543 West Division. You can get tickets at thehousetheater.com. I want to compliment you for spelling theater the right way, which is T-R-E at the end.
Yep.
Yeah, we're very British here. And Vanessa Stalling, I look forward to your next directing endeavor, which will be what, by the way? Do you know yet?
I'll be doing The Wolves over at Goodman Theater this winter.
Great, I will see that. And Brenda Berry, we'll look forward to you. Do you have your, even though I've just cast you in the Bowser role, are you anything else coming up?
No, this has all my focus right now.
Okay, as it should, because it's an intense role, as we heard just leading into it. I didn't want to interrupt that monologue because it was so intense.
Just
brava on that. And Eric Schroeder, of course, welcome home, my friend. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
And I'm sure we'll talk again. Once again, thehousetheater.com, theater spelled T-R-E at the end, or you can call 773-769-3832. An important part of our history, United Flight 232, brought to life through the talent of Vanessa Stalling and through the skills and talent of Brenda Berry and the love of Eric Schroeder. I got you all in there.
The cheerleading. Yeah.
You got it. Thank you, guys. Have a great rest of the run of the show. It's October 21st is the date. People ought to check it out. I appreciate you.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.